Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival, and I'm very thrilled to be talking to Jane Smiley, whose new book is Good Faith. I notice with every book that the security and confidence with which these books are narrated becomes still more forceful. I mean, you know, I was saying to someone the other day that Jane Smiley is like a novelist who has decided that she's only going to write what she wants, that it's like a kid who's going to use her favorite Criollas in the box and no others, and it becomes more and more pleasurable all the time. From the beginning, there have been novels and short stories and novellas. Most recently, Horse Heaven, The All True Travels and Adventures of Lydie Newton, Moo, 1,000 Acres, two of my favorites, The Greenlanders and The Age of Grief, Duplicate Keys at Paradise Gate, Barn Blind, and now Good Faith. I'm very curious, and people don't speak about this very easily, but what is involved in the development of narrative confidence?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that with this book, because I didn't have much confidence with this book. I had just finished Horse Heaven, which I really loved, and which is pretty much in my own omniscient narrative voice, and I could say whatever I wanted in Horse Heaven because I had to be informative in order to lead the average person through this really strange world of horse racing. And I just enjoyed that a lot. And so when I came to write this book, I had to, in some sense, shrink my narrative voice so that it would plausibly fit not only Joey, who's a male narrator, and a little bit naive, but also didn't know what was going to happen to him, and I did. And so I found it quite uncomfortable. I found it quite uncomfortable to figure out how to tell his story without telegraphing everything and without making him sound like a boob.
Well, one of the things that I noticed is that very quickly he's surprised by a woman he never knew was attracted to him, the younger sister of a girl he used to go out with, now dead, who basically ditched him. But she moves in.
Well, Sally moved on. You know, yes. She was the kind of girl who arranges things, and she arranged him and moved on. He sort of understood that.
But now there's her sister, and she moves in with a surprise so quickly. Mm-hmm. And within a couple of seconds, she's saying, follow me in your car. Or, and you just say, how did this happen so fast? You know. And I think that when things like that happen that are surprising to the characters, they generate a kind of momentum. Mm-hmm. And the reader is surprised too, especially if the characters who in older books spend entire novels getting each other into bed, especially if they do it in 7 or 8 pages, it really feels like the novel is flying.
Well, you know, that was the 80s. You know, I think there were two generations that were really blown over by the 80s. One was the baby boom generation, who was turning 30 and sort of who was coming off drugs and sex and sort of waking up to family life. But there was an older group who were like 10 years older who had, the 70s had found them stuck with the kids and the house and the marriage. And I think by 1980 or the early 80s, that group that was 40 then felt that the good times were passing them by. And so one of the things that they did was I've got to strike while the iron is hot. You know, whatever the iron is, if it's money or looks or sex or whatever, my life is passing and I have to get something now or I'll never get it. And so that's how old Joey and Felicity are at the beginning of the novel. He's 40 and she's 39.
Now, your last three books have been largely comedies or picaresques, mm-hmm. It's quite a decision. I remember I was talking at Knopf to Bobby Bristol when she first got the manuscript of Moo in the mail, and she didn't seem to know what to do. She seemed to think that if she left it on a shelf for a while, it would turn into a serious book. Uh-huh. And she said, I'm going to let it sit for a while, and then I'm going to talk to Jane Smiley and see if this is really the
I've
next
never
book
heard this before,
that she yeah. wanted to mm. do. And I think eventually what happened was that she came to like the book rather
well,
than...
you know, actually what happened was, as far as I can remember, was that I separated the threads of the narrative. And I made each piece of the narrative a good story, and in the rewriting, and then I wove them back together again, and then more or less she could see what I was getting at, because she could follow the various characters through a sensible and interesting story. But, you know, the problem with A Thousand Acres was that for everyone, and apparently in the world other than me, it was enthralling. It wasn't enthralling for me. It was just a book as far as I was concerned. And when I was done with it, I was done with it. And I wanted to go on to something new. And I remember when I was just starting out, I was watching TV and I was watching Paul Simon talk about writing a song on some show. And he played parts of the song. It's a beautiful song. I can't even remember what it was, but it was one of his greats, you know. And he played parts of the song, and then he talked about how he wrote it. And he said, now here I'm coming to the bridge, and the bridge is supposed to refresh the ear. And the interviewer didn't care about the bridge, but Paul Simon, the interviewer cared about the beauty and the emotion of the song. And Paul Simon cared about the technique that created the beauty and the emotion of the song. And that really turned a light on in me. I said, oh, that's how you do it. And there's a certain coldness in the composer or the author that is the coldness of technique. And so the composer or the author never experiences the book in the same way that the reader does. The reader is supposed to have ups and downs of emotion and whatever, but the author doesn't have those. The author says, well, here I did this, and here I did this, and here I had to wrestle around with this. And so for the author, the book is a much cooler endeavor than for the reader. So when I went from A Thousand Acres, which had a far greater effect on everybody else than it had on me, it seemed natural to go to Moo and do a comedy and be refreshed and think about something new and think about things in a different way. But it was hard to put it over on my editor, I guess.
but it seems to have taken. You seem to really, you know, enjoy with a great verve the comic novel.
Oh, yeah, I have a comic sensibility. And, you know, when I was in graduate school and I was taking courses in Shakespeare, it always struck me that the tragedies came before the late comedies, and that King Lear came before Winter's Tale. He had something that was bugging him, let's say, in his 30s, that he found some kind of key to or resolution of by the time he came to the late comedies. And that always seemed to me like the perfect authorial arc. You know, get rid of the tragedies early and then address the issues of joy and redemption.
That's interesting, because it's the opposite in Dickens.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not true, because Our Mutual Friend is quite a redeemed novel.
Yeah, but mostly you think of Dickens as starting out with the Pickwick Papers and going toward things like Little Dorrit, and even Our Mutual Friend has its very kind of grisly aspects. But the thing that I was thinking of is something that Joe Gargery says in Great Expectations, He says it about a little poem he wrote for his father's epitaph. And he says, Joe Gargery is a blacksmith. He said, I made it. I made it as easy as bending a nail. And with Dickens, you do get that sense, and it's what I'm talking about in You Too, of something that has become beautifully easy. I'm not saying that the writing is easy. I'm saying that the impression that it leaves on the reader is of pleasure, improvisation, wonder what's going to happen tonight, you know, people picking up the book to say, oh, I hope she's got a good one going, you know. And I think that that is something that, well, unless a writer writes steadily and a lot, I don't think that kind of ease develops.
Well, I think that's true. And I really love to write novels. So I'd almost rather do that in the course of the day than anything. You know? I love to ride horses, too. And of course, I love to deal with family life. But, you know, your family never changes. It doesn't progress. It doesn't have a sort of narrative arc. They just have to be dressed every day. And then after they learn to dress themselves, they have to be fed every day. And then after they learn to feed themselves, they have to be told to get jobs. You know, there's just something very same about family life. My other great sort of personal learning endeavor has been horseback riding. And that's much more difficult than novel writing. It's because it's the same thing as any physical thing, where you have to get that physical memory. You have to do it right so many times that your body does it right automatically. It takes a lot of hard work and precision and perspiration. And I always say, I'm not so good on the perspiration part, but I'm okay on the inspiration part.
I'm talking to Jane Smiley about her new novel, Good Faith, published by Knopf. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, there's a character here named Marcus Byrne. And, you know, there are several things that people do when they encounter him. They make the sign of the cross and they, you know, talk about wearing crucifixes to him. But he does strike even your characters as the devil.
Well, maybe too good to be true. If that's what you think the devil is, then he's kind of the devil.
How do you make a character who's going to win everyone and yet keep the reader unsettled?
Well, it's hard. You know, I had to think a lot about Marcus, and I guess what I did was I put myself in Marcus's shoes, but I also put myself in Joey's shoes. You know, how would a person come into my life and talk me out of things that I know are true? But also, how would I go, and what would motivate me to go into somebody else's life and talk them out of things that are true? Well, sincerity. I might truly believe what I'm saying, and yet I think one of the things that happens is Marcus gets his sister, whose name is Jane, to come and help him. And Joey and Jane are talking at one point, and she says, you know, our family couldn't believe that you guys actually believed Marcus or trusted him. And I wanted to indicate that Marcus had a reputation in his own family of being an incompetent big talker. And yet, everything he says is true. When he comes to Joey's hometown, the things that he advises Joey and his friends to do turn out to be right. And so, in some sense, he sounds like a BSer, but in fact, he says people will buy these condos, or people will do this, or people will want this, and they do. So maybe he does have his finger on the pulse. Maybe he does know more than these guys do. And maybe the thing that he knows the best is how greedy he himself is. And so by extrapolating from his own sense of greed. He can tap into the larger or smaller bits of greediness in the people around him.
Well, he's sort of my favorite kind of American character, the con man. But the con man who keeps alternating between having a heart of gold and a tongue of quicksilver. Mm-hmm. So it's like the character in The Music Man. You do think, absolutely, he's come to the small town and things are more interesting since he got there. And he might be lying to everyone, but he's more fun than anyone. And it really is true. And you kind of nail it here because throughout the book, what he's offering people is we're going to have fun. Mm-hmm. And it's the 80s, and they want fun more than anything else. And
you deserve something. You know, you deserve Italian tile. Why shouldn't you have Italian tile in the bath in your bathroom? Well, you might think, well, that's true. Why shouldn't I? It's prettier than tile made in Rochester, New York, and it's not that much more expensive. So why shouldn't I have it? So pretty soon you're going from Italian tile to golf courses. And bit by bit, you've been led into thinking that you deserve this fabulous golf course, or you deserve something else that maybe you would have not imagined yourself.
Well, I love his polar opposites, Joey's parents, who aren't types that said who invite missionaries for dinner. Mm-hmm. And yet, they do have $10,000 to lend Joey when he has nothing, and he is living in their duplex, and, you know, they are the people, ultimately, they're the only people in the book who can take him in. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has been taken in by a con man. They've been gulled. But, you know, these values, which are somehow or other seen in the book to be boring but dependable, and it becomes very moving to be with these particular people. Are they the moral center for you of the book?
Well, no, I don't think the book has a moral center because because they're extreme to the other side. You know, Joey says that his father's idea of what manhood is submitting to the will of God. And in America, that's pretty extreme to express that. You know, not to do the work of God or to do God's business on earth, but to submit to the will of God is just not an American thing to do. And the parents' religious beliefs are even far to the right of the evangelical Christians. At one point, Joey says of his father that if he hadn't been an inherently kindly man, he would have been a sincere and effective tyrant. So, so it's only by an accident of temperament that Joey has gotten a father who's a good man and a kind man, as well as a man who really doesn't spare the rod and never did. So Joey, to me, Joey, his parents' values have not prepared him for American life. They haven't prepared him for how to grow up in a world of temptation without rejecting everything. They haven't prepared him to select how to be good in America.
If you were to prepare a manual, preferably comic, on how to prepare someone for American life, what would it include?
I would say watch the Disney Channel a lot. No, I'm not joking. I have a 10-year-old son, and he loves to watch the Disney Channel. And when I go in and watch it with him, all the shows and all the movies are about the moral dilemmas of children. You know, one of them I was watching with him that was quite interesting to me was about a black child in Alabama in the early 60s who joins a civil rights march, and the men on horses come in and scatter the marchers, and the child has to be picked up and saved. And so this causes several conversations in the household, which is a black household, about what to do next. and other shows like Malcolm in the Middle, you know, they always talk about moral dilemmas and how you should be true to yourself. And my 10-year-old son talks in a much more sophisticated way about how to deal with conflicting temptations than my students did when I was teaching college, especially the male students, than I did when I was 10 years old. And so I'm joking around, but I'm also saying that I think that children have to be exposed to the world that they're going to live in, and rather than protected from it, so that they can negotiate the inputs that they're getting. You know, they have to go to the toy store and see all the things they want in order to be able to say, well, I want this more than this, so I'll take this one. You know, they have to watch TV or play video games so that at the moment that they're allowed to play them at like 16 or 17, if you'd restricted them, they don't just have this avalanche of... when I had girls who were small, we had Barbies passing through the house, you know, in a wave. I had every Barbie there ever was. And they were all they were all dressed in pink and lavender, you know, and the girls wanted to wear pink and lavender. And in the end, the girls didn't become Barbies. They became responsible, educated women. But they had to have that Barbie experience in order to decide, well, maybe I don't want to wear pink and lavender and high heels for the rest of my life.
At the end of Good Faith, Felicity appears perfectly unexpected, mm-hmm, on a ski lift next to our narrator. And although she has been hardly as cuddlesome as she may have seemed, and both depraved and gullible, you know, she's the, mm-hmm, pure mix in the novel of fooler and fooled, he decides that she represents material grace in the physical world and seems ready to go with her. Is that what happened at the end of the 80s?
Well, you know, it's what happened to Joe. It's not necessarily what happened to anybody, everybody. But one of the things that happens after a period of license, which is what the 80s was, is a kind of understanding of what freedom is. Freedom isn't the same as license, but it also, once you've broken the rules no longer apply. You can't go back and be inside the rules again. And what happens in my view at the end of the 80s and into the 90s was people took a deep breath and said, well, what is freedom really, and how do I want to use my freedom? And what would I get from it if I used it? And I believe Felicity's feelings for Joe were always sincere. And in addition to that, Felicity always had a kind of exuberance and sort of let's do it attitude that was not predatory or exploitive, you know, but was sort of let's have fun together, not let me screw you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of amazing because Good Faith, one of its pleasures is that while I'd say it's a moral novel, it's not a scold. And it doesn't seem to, you know, be about a situation of greed that, mm-hmm, can't be rectified. Rather, it seems to know that on the roller coaster, this was the greedy curve, mm-hmm, and now there may be another thing before we hit another height and another depth, but it seems to know that things change.
Well, I'm 53 years old, you know, and one of the things that happens when you're still writing novels in your 50s was you think, oh, I'm still alive. You know, And the Greenlanders ended with everybody dying off.
It's one of my favorite books.
Yeah. You know, I love the Greenlanders, and it was true to its origins in the Icelandic period, and also it was true to its mythic origins with, you know, Ragnarok and the end of civil and the end of reality, essentially. But I remember at the end of A Thousand Acres, I really scratched my head and said, "What now, poor?" Poor, what's her name, the main character of A Thousand Acres, is working in a Denny's and right outside, right next to Highway 35 in Minneapolis. What a life, you know. But I couldn't carry her any farther than that because I didn't have the imagination to do so. But now I'm older than I was when I wrote A Thousand Acres, and I've seen many more years go by, and I know that what seems like a cataclysm in your life when you're 40 turns out to be just something that happened when you look back on it when you're 50 or 55. And I know many people now who are in their 50s and 60s, and most of them have had two or three lives. And they're no less joyful in some cases than they were. And in other cases, they're no less depressed than they were, even though their lives are on the face of it, better or worse than they were than when they were 35. And so to me, that's hopeful. And also, that's what the novel is about. It's the drama or the movie where the cataclysm happens, the screen goes black, the credits roll, and that's the thing you're left with. Or the curtain comes down and, you know, that's the thing you're left with. That's movies, operas, dramas. The novel is not about that. The novel, the narrator is still talking at the end. So where there's life, there's hope. You know, where there's a voice that's still talking, there's somebody that's saying, "I'm still with you. I'm still with you." And whatever, you know, if the chapter ends now, next chapter will begin, and I'll still be talking. You
know? The result is that my guest, Jane Smiley, has written a generous novel about greed. I've been speaking with Jane Smiley, author most recently of Good Faith. You can read the first chapter of Good Faith on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is J.C. Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.